The first presentation is on improving aquaculture governance, which is the status. What is the status and what and who is responsible for what? By Dr. Nathaniel Ishamunda from FAO. Dr. Nathaniel Ishamunda is a senior aquaculture officer in charge of economics, policy and planning with the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, FAO, Rome. He holds a PhD in agricultural economics from Auburn University, USA, and a master's degree in aquaculture with focus on aquaculture economics from the same institution, and an engineering degree in agriculture from the Rwanda National University. Dr. Ishamunda has extensive field experience working with FAO member countries worldwide in the formulation and implementation of policies, strategies, and plans for sustainable aquaculture development. He authored and co-authored numerous articles in scientific journals, FAO technical papers, book chapters, and monographs in aquaculture economics, policy, and governance. Dr. Nathaniel, the floor is yours, please.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, everybody. My talk today will be about improving aquaculture governance, what is the status, and who is responsible for what. And I will be talking on behalf of Professor Riedler, Professor David Percy, Dr. Ben Satya, Dr. Pedro Bueno, Imtiaz Ahmad, Jeff Gulley, Wilson Mwanja, Ulf Wickstrom, Blaise Kwemlangen, Severi San, and Cecile Brugel. To do this, I suggest to follow the following outline. I will revisit the understanding of aquaculture governance, since this concept was partially explored by Professor Riedler this morning in the plenary. And we will then examine what is the current knowledge in aquaculture governance, that is, what is the current global status. And then, in so doing, we will visit the principle of good governance in aquaculture, the current types of governance as we experience them today, and possibly talk about some governance tools, and that will lead us to who does what, what is the responsibility of each stakeholder. We will then see aquaculture governance in the new millennium with the goal of seeing whether the expectations stated within the Bangkok Declaration 10 years ago were met or not. And that, obviously, will lead us to examining the outstanding issues and hopefully suggest some priorities for action. As Professor Riedler this morning said, there is really no commonly accepted definition of aquaculture governance or governance as such in general. But broadly speaking, it's a means by which a government exercises the authority in managing its country's economic and social resources or a particular industry, such as aquaculture. And it also includes the processes by which decisions are made and implemented, and how conflicting interests are reconciled. And I will not repeat what Professor Riedler said. I will just rephrase it and say that governance allows investment to take place and last. It also allows the sector to grow and last, which means, really, its goal is sustainability. And sustainability, like I said, is understood in terms of its four main aspects: technological soundness, economic viability, environmental integrity, and social license or equity. And what we know today is that there are some principles of good governance in aquaculture. At least that's what we get from the literature when we search it. And one of them is accountability. Accountability, which is nothing but the acknowledgement and assumption of responsibility for action, decisions, policies, and products by officials, which means openness of administration for the answerability to the public and to the institutional stakeholders for their actions, which also implies performance-based standards for officials and the mechanisms for reporting, auditing, and enforcement. This normally will result in a timely decision-making and stakeholder participation. Another principle we know is guiding governance today is effectiveness and efficiency of public services, and we'll see why. And simply speaking, effectiveness means doing the right thing, which means it measures the quality and decency of what we do. And efficiency is doing things the right way, which means it measures the speed and the cost at which we do things. And this is important in the way we manage the sector. The third aspect or principle of good governance as we see it today is equity or social license. It's the feeling by all members of community or society that they have a stake in and are a part of the mainstream society, which means that all groups, especially vulnerable ones, like women, as we normally say, have opportunities to improve or maintain their well-being through aquaculture activities in this case. It also implies guaranteeing procedural fairness and distributional justice, as well as participation to priority setting and decision-making processes to all. The fourth aspect, as we see it today, is predictability, which refers to the fair and the consistent application of laws, regulations, and implementation of policies. That means they should not vary according to the person they apply to. What we know also today in the current global status of governance is that where governance has been really used and taken seriously, we see a trend leading to three main principal types of governance. And these are hierarchical governance. It is like Professor Ridler said, somewhat similar to the traditional concept of government with elites and top-down decision-making. What it means is that governments develop policies independently and leave producers to manage their farms, for example, which implies that it's enforced by legal force, meaning laws and regulations. This approach has its own merits. It has authority and provides clear guidelines. But it also has some disadvantages. It's costly and difficult to enforce. And because farmers' participation is almost non-existent, compliance is difficult. Therefore, this kind of governance tends to be ineffective. Another type of governance is market-driven governance. It leaves aquaculture development to demand and supply forces mainly. And then the implication is that it is enforced by prices, administrative mechanisms such as licenses, certification schemes, and others, incentives. And the merits are efficient allocation of resources as the prices dictates, and then the sector normally develops well. The problem is market failures or externalities as the investors, entrepreneurs pursue their own interest, their own profit. Normally they take little care to the environment, for example. And this, in some cases, could lead to social unrest. A third type of governance is a participatory governance. It extends from industry self-regulation to co-management of the sector by industry representatives and government regulators and to community partnerships. It's normally enforced by peer pressure through codes of practice, farmers associations, incentives for product certification, and so forth. The merits of this type of governance are the low transaction cost, as one can imagine, and there is a relatively high degree of compliance because of participation, and therefore it's relatively effective. The problem is normally the lack of authority, and it's very difficult to coordinate. Now, what do we know about governance tools used today? Some of them, obviously, are laws and regulations, depending on the type of governance you're using. We also have administrative instruments like licenses, certification schemes, peer pressure, means self-regulation, and some policy instruments, including policies themselves, strategies, plans, economic and fiscal incentives. Now, the next point is, who does what? What is the responsibility? What are the responsibilities of stakeholders? Generally speaking, we have two categories of stakeholders. The first is the public sector or the governments, and the second is the private sector. The public sector generally provides enabling environment in terms of securing property rights, ensuring political stability, providing some public goods, including road infrastructures, and services such as research. It also supports the industry in some places through seed, through using the monetary incentives, fiscal incentives, investing in technologies from time to time. And the goal is to reduce cost and the risk to entrepreneurs, because the government then is taking up some of the costs which entrepreneurs will normally undertake. It also regulates, administer, and guide the management of the industry. And the goal is to reduce market failures, of course. As I said, if you leave the industry, the entrepreneurs to lead the industry themselves, normally they would ignore the long-term viability of the sector. They look at the short-term profits, which could lead to disasters, has in fact led to disasters in many countries. It's also to protect, obviously, the society at large. Now, the private sector, or what I call other stakeholders, which include the industry. Normally, the industry which operates under producer associations. The producer associations, as we see them today, act as lobby groups to represent aqua farmers' interests. They can also act as a means of exchanging information and diffusing technical knowledge. They can also act as an institution for managing shared natural resources and acting as financial intermediaries, issuing credit, for example. They also act as marketing agents and monitors for environmental self-policing through self-regulation. Under the private sector, we have also the local communities. Local communities participate in decision-making processes, and there is an economic rationale for adopting a participatory approach. First of all, participation reduces transaction enforcement cost by increasing acceptance and compliance by farmers. It also improves aquaculture's public image by educating the public. It enhances productivity by incorporating local knowledge in decision making. Someone was underlying this aspect yesterday, that yes, we can develop high tech to manage the sector, to have the sector develop, but we need to incorporate indigenous knowledge in our decision making. The problem is that normally there are questions about the effectiveness and the cost efficiency of participation. Beside participation, where there are neither externalities nor economies of scale, as with site selection, for example, local communities are usually able to make their own decisions based on their own priorities, which means normally governments decentralize. And as the government decentralizes, then local communities can determine the route that much aquaculture governance will follow in the future. The problem is that decentralization requires not only local decision-making, but also local fiscal capacity. And most developing countries have experimented this with decentralization, but have faced resistance to the move of personnel from central to local jurisdictions. The third component of the private sector, as we see it in the governance today, is NGOs or non-governmental organizations. Non-governmental organizations can have a constructive role and be a useful counterweight in aquaculture governance by acting as environmental and social watchdogs through putting pressure on business to increase transparency and improve working conditions of workers. Lobby groups putting pressure on businesses with short-term horizons, and participants in decision-making as well, processes. And in some places, they have been part of aquaculture advisory boards. They can also develop and disseminate guidelines for better management practices, BMPs. But there are some issues. What we see is that normally NGOs are not accountable, unlike, for example, politicians who are often democratically elected and are held accountable to the constituency. They do not generally compromise, and they may narrowly satisfy single-issue partisans who may not be representative of the broader society. It is also feared that reliance on donor funding can lead to sensationalism in order to attract media attention. And the result may be vociferous rejection of aquaculture without weighing benefits that accrue from the sector. Now, the third part of the presentation is to examine aquaculture in the third millennium, with the goal of assessing whether the Bangkok Declaration's expectations were met. Let's look at what these expectations were first. The Bangkok Declaration expected countries and organizations to strengthen institutional capacity, establish and implement transparent and enforceable policy and regulatory frameworks, establish and implement consistent and responsible policies and goals which encourage sustainable development of the sector. And to do so, they have to improve cooperation and among stakeholders at national, regional, international levels, involve organizations and institutions representing the private sector, including NGOs, consumers and other stakeholders in the management of the sector, identify a lead agency with adequate organizational stature to play a strong coordinating role. I just extracted this from the declaration. Now, what does the assessment show? It shows that a yes or no answer is probably not possible. And therefore, we just have to make a qualitative assessment and compare it to the expectations of before. What we see is that aquaculture governance improved tremendously, be it in Asia, Africa, Europe, and the Americas. Examples are that FAO Code of Conduct for Responsible Fisheries, for example, became a guide to two most national codes of practices. So FAO published guidelines for reducing administrative burdens and for improving planning and policy development in aquaculture. And obviously, we have experienced national aquaculture development laws, policies, strategies, and plans almost all over the world, but not in all countries. We also see that better management practices were encouraged and or adopted in many countries. Communication through networking developed tremendously, and at least in the process, this is a case of ANAF. ANAF, as Jansen Gia said yesterday, it's a network for aquaculture in Africa. Similar network is developed in Europe, Latin America, and so forth. Institutions were strengthened in many countries. Producer associations were encouraged and created with the aim of promoting participation by stakeholders. Lead agencies were created in many areas. And with hierarchical and market-driven governance progressively giving way to participatory governance, stakeholders' involvement in decision-making processes is increasingly becoming the norm almost all over the world. With increased participation come enhanced transparency, equity, and stability of policies and regulations, regulatory frameworks, what the Bangkok Declaration had asked for. But governance remains an issue in many countries, as experienced by, exemplified by conflicts over sites, disease outbreaks, still important public mistrust of aquaculture in some places, inability of small-scale producers to meet stringent market standards, inadequate development of the sector in certain countries, despite good supply conditions and high demand for aquatic products, an indication that the road is still long. Now, what are some of the burning issues? First one is that I've been warned that my time is running short. So I will probably don't go into as many details as I had prepared. But the first issue is overregulation in some places. And overregulation, as we all know, deters investors and leads to lack of enforcement. The second issue is that the resources constraints limit participation to governance, and yet we have said it's extremely important. The information remains also a big issue. I'm saying this because the Bangkok Declaration said that the collection and dissemination of accurate and verifiable information on aquaculture may help to improve its public image and should be given attention. Research is generally underfunded. I think the previous speakers yesterday raised also this issue. On this point, the Bangkok Declaration emphasized the need to increase investment in aquaculture research whilst making efficient use of research resources. And today, very limited resources are allocated to aquaculture research, especially in developing countries. We also think that the social license or acceptability of aquaculture will remain an issue. I think someone from Chile yesterday raised this, and we fully agree with his observation. There is also trade. Trade is likely to be a constraining factor to aquaculture development, especially in developing countries. This is because there is an increasing public interest in food safety and animal welfare, and a stronger influence of the retail sector in the dictating standards of aquaculture products, which could limit access to markets by small-scale producers and therefore to the supply itself. There is an issue of climate change, which we think, in addition perhaps to bringing some positive benefits, it could also lead to some negative impacts, including disease outbreaks, for example, or the restriction of aquaculture infrastructures like cages in case of severe weather. Another one, the financial imbalances resulting from the global recession. We think this one could limit the funding for the sector, and therefore the sector will find it difficult to develop. There is an emergency of oligopolies in the industry concentration. Oligopoly could lead, at the end of the day, to environmental damage, as some countries compete to attract investment. And then investment, since they have the monopoly, they would probably influence much the labor market and then ask for compensation. And this could lead to environmental disaster and social uprising. There is a special issue on offshore aquaculture. Offshore aquaculture is likely to, aquaculture is likely to move offshore as land and water, fresh water become scarce. And with this, shall offshore aquaculture lead open oceans? Then this could be a big problem, since there is a legal vacuum. We'll come back to this. Then some priority actions, as I'm asked to leave in a few minutes. We think that there is a need to develop guidelines for aquaculture governance worldwide, enhance institutional capacity in order to enable countries to establish, implement, monitor, and enforce regulations, need to continue empowering local communities in aquaculture governance, continue working on a means to mitigate the impact of climate change in aquaculture, need to improve research and development, continue looking for ways of pushing aquaculture further offshore. And with this, I close my intervention. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nathaniel, for a very interesting presentation. May I please now invite the panel members on the stage and open the floor for discussion. Please, if you can. And can I also ask you to introduce yourself very briefly, just state your name and from where you come from.
Good morning. My name is Blaise Kwemlangan with the Legal Office of the Food and Agriculture Organization.
My name is Wilson Mwanja with the Ministry of Culture, Animal Industry and Fisheries, Uganda.
Good morning. My name is Savali Sen. I'm an economist and I'm a consultant based in Australia.
Benedict Satya, University of Washington.
Jeff Gooley, Department of Prime Ministries, Victoria, Australia.
Cécile Brugère, economist, part of the Aquaculture Service of FAO.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Now the floor is open for discussion. Can I please ask you to have short questions and please introduce yourself, your name, and from where you come from before you ask the question. We have two microphones over there. Please, please.
Thank you. I am Rene Agbayani from the Southeast Asian Fisheries Development Center, SIFDEC. And we have done a lot of community engagement as far as promoting aquaculture as a means of livelihood. You know. In the presentation, I guess, there's not much focus in terms of what is happening on the ground, what is happening on the local level, how are community-based organizations being governed, because we feel that aquaculture governance is most critical in the local level, in the community level. Whatever good governance is done at the top level, it becomes useless unless it's really workable in the local level. Could you share with us some of the more effective mechanisms in terms of governance or co-management, if we may say, in the local communities? Thank you.
Yes, can I ask our lead panelist? Yes?
Thank you very much. I can only share your observation that actually, if governance is done from the top to down, it would only be useless. I think I underlined this in my presentation. It will be ineffective because people will not simply comply. And now, as I said, perhaps I didn't I didn't put too much emphasis on that because of the limited time. As I said, there is a tendency now to shift away from that top-down type of governance to participatory governance, which means you involve the communities at local level to into the decision-making processes. And this is happening in some places, which I think to be too onerous to name, but the process by which they do this is normally to have farmers group them into clusters or into associations at the local level. And then they would have representatives to go and have a stake in whatever decision is being made in terms of managing resources. And the most commonly managed resources using the co-management approach is water. Water is generally a very serious problem in many places. And so I was saying that the most commonly solved problem using the co-management approach is the problem of water. Water is becoming a big problem in terms of scarcity. And so this scarcity leads to conflicts. And local communities are organized to be able to manage and that resource and find a solution to that problem. But there are limitations. There are limitations to that kind of approach. And as I underlined this, participation requires money and time. And money, especially, is almost always a limiting factor. And so, being a limiting factor, the resources being limited, participation is also limited. And I think that's why then, as a matter of governance, countries should be called upon to increase, where possible, the funding for aquaculture, which could lead to the solution of these kind of problems.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 questions coming up. So can I start from here, and then we go there and we come.
My name is Javier Martinez Cordero from Mexico. Congratulations on this presentation. It's just a comment. It's not really a question. I was very interested in your final slide. You are suggesting for future work to develop sort of guidelines for improving aquaculture governance in the world. And I think something probably important to include is how to take decisions when information is not complete, which is most of the cases. Actually, or our government officials in all of our countries, they have to take everyday decisions with really incomplete information or on all these problems we know about information. So it would be very interesting for them as part of these guidelines to show or to give examples, whatever, of how can they do this process of decision making in a better way, because the information is never going to be complete. So I guess that's a very important thing. Yesterday I was mentioning about unregistered, unrecorded aquaculture. I don't want to go back to that issue, but that's really a fact in many of our countries, for example, Latin America, where I come from. And yet we see our government officials, they need to take decisions day by day. So for improving this governance, that would be very interesting to be included. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think this is a comment. So may I ask the gentleman in the back, please, for the next question.
Dr. Nathaniel, thanks for your very comprehensive and empirical analysis of these presentations. I'm wondering, in regard with the sustainability of the poor communities, their sustainability of their livelihoods. So in regard to it, I have a few, not few, with various experience in developing countries. I have been noticed in regard with the sustainable of the project, development projects, and which are different stakeholders' involvement. So in regard with the sustainability of the project, any development project, say time frame 3 to 5 years, any development projects, and I saw it after the project phase out, if you think about the poor communities follow up to have the situations after the project, as I understand there are accountability in the project document as well of the different stakeholders to follow up after the projects. And in that case I just a bitter experience, the people of let's say like a Minister of Fisheries, and they have a development partners, and they are talking about, oh, we don't have money, that there is no other rooms after the follow up to project to look at how the situation, say such for example, the extension worker as in a Ministry of Fisheries, Ministry of Fisheries is a different developing countries as well, is a different their capacity as well in terms of the fund. But some developing countries doesn't have money to follow up.
I'm sorry, you are asking a question?
Yes, just a question.
Please,
so
if you can make it a bit shorter.
It should be have some things in the sustainability to the poor communities as well. It should have something, some room for the development partners to have something, even the respective host countries as well. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. So, anybody wants to take the question, please, from the panel members, please.
I'm going to comment from an FAO project approach, and I think what our observer has said relates to how you formulate projects so that there is sustainability. And yes, indeed, lots of projects, perhaps in the last 2 decades, we have not seen the uptake by governments, the uptake by communities, or the target group of the results of the projects. And what we have seen also over maybe the last decade is that a gradual move to encourage donors and external partners to ensure that the uptake aspect of projects are integrated in the formulation process as well as the project document itself. Now, that is from an FAO perspective. Of course, there are many instances where this is not there, and there is no monitoring to ensure that the uptake aspect is actually implemented. And there's still a need for improvement on this. Perhaps my other colleagues in FAO might want to add, but this is this trend, at least from the FAO perspective.
I think I will just be very brief. You have said it all. What I would suggest is that from the very beginning, local communities should be made aware of the fact that each project has an end. And this being said, they should be prepared to take over once the project ends. And therefore, during the formulation phase, there should be an exit strategy, to my view, an exit strategy once the project ends. Who is going to take over the services, for example, which the farmers were receiving during the project? How this will be done? This should be a part of the project document, to my view, in order to solve the sustainability problem.
I think we had a... Thank you very much. We had a gentleman here, no? Yes, please. Him first.
Thank you. In Chinese, the governance and the management is almost the same. We don't have the two phrases. So can you explain a little bit the difference between governance and management?
Well, governance, as was explained this morning by Professor Ritler and by Dr. Hishamunda, is the process by which a government manages its social and economic responsibilities. And we've moved this to different levels or different types, that at times it is market-driven, it's also participatory, and we hope that we will continue to be participatory. Management, on the other hand, is the technique by which you achieve a particular purpose or objective. So when you start off, you are thinking in management, you set up an objective, something which you are going to get or meet, and you decide what strategies will permit you to get to that end. That is where the management comes in. And I don't know if the explanation is, if you can understand the difference. But when you are talking of management, management may not necessarily take into account the equity aspect, because what you are looking at is to attain a particular objective which has been decided from the beginning. Whereas in governance, it is much more wider than management.
Okay, thank you very much. So, yes, please.
Thank you. Atoda is my name. I'm from the National Program for Food Security in Nigeria. I'm very excited about the presentation of Dr. Ishamunda. Dr. Ishamunda, I can recall you were in Nigeria about 5 years ago. You could see the level of aquaculture development there. I can assure you now it's even far, far much greater. But we have a unique problem in Nigeria, which I know most other developing countries have, in terms of regulations and control. It's so difficult in the anxiety to develop. So a lot of people come in, and at the end of the day, you have so much quacks and fakes, giving people wrong advice and all sorts of things. I don't know whether any member of the panel has an experience to share with us how we can combat this unique problem of inability to enforce the regulatory mechanisms, whereby, and at the same time, sustaining the growth in the aquaculture section. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. I think, it is of particular concern for developing countries, but it's not only developing countries. We have seen that the problem of ensuring proper regulation and control exists in also developed economies. In any case, I think the point of departure for this particular discussion was the observations made by the speakers yesterday. I noted in particular, I think it was Carlos that mentioned the conflict between overregulation. And yet he mentioned in his same presentation the need for regulation. And then there was also an observation by the lead speaker on giving an overview of European aquaculture, him saying that there is a need for participation of stakeholders in the lawmaking process. So I want to touch on that point. I think regulation and control is facilitated if you have the regulator involved in the lawmaking process. Because we believe in FAO that lawmaking is not just substance of the law, but also a process. And I think this was the point was made also by Dr. Ishamunda today, which is that if you want participation, if you want compliance, then you would have to involve the communities or the people who are regulated in the lawmaking process as well as the management. There is no clear answer to how you can, especially when you have lack of capacity, lack of resources in developing countries to have good regulation, that would also be enforced. And so the way around this is to encourage self-regulation and compliance. And I would like to use the example of Thailand, which has not, we have tried to come up with a new regulation for Thailand. We have been partners in developing a new legal framework for Thailand. But in terms of aquaculture, they had really shied away from actual formal regulation, and that allowed stakeholders to see if they can, and the market and other interests to see if they can regulate themselves. So they have moved, and I think they have they have managed to come up with some kind of arrangement where you have compliance with standards that are not in overly and codified regulations. So that would be our approach in FAO, to ensure and to try to solve the problem of good regulation and ensuring control. David, do you want to?
I would just like to add one comment, and it also arose in the comment from the gentleman from Mexico at the beginning. Your question was, how do you make decisions with imperfect knowledge? And this gentleman's question was, how do you concentrate on regulation with scarce administrative resources? And in each case, I'm a great believer in an initial risk assessment, so that resources are focused where the risk is highest. And we, as we know with aquaculture operations, they range from, frankly, minimally controversial, requiring minimum supervision, at one end of the scale, to extremely controversial, perhaps introducing exotic species, some aspects of offshore aquaculture, which would be much more potentially dangerous. And it may sound excessively simplistic, but the answer is to focus the scarce resources on the potentially most dangerous cases, the most controversial cases, and to leave the least controversial ones to a great deal of self-regulation and self-reporting.
Okay, thank you very much. We have only something about 5 minutes left for questions, comments, reflections. So can I ask... So we'll take three more questions, and can I ask you to be very short and in your in few sentences your questions and your statement, please. The lady maybe from the back there first, and then two, three, four. Okay, please. Short question, please.
Thank you. This is actually not a question, but an expansion of the comment by the gentleman a while ago with regards to self-regulation. In Thailand, we have a very good system, I should say, that dates back many, many years. And it has existed together with the government regulatory framework. But the existing one, which has been very effective, is a community-based one. And the sense of community is very, very important in making this possible. And it occurs at various levels, from the provincial level down to the district, and then the municipalities, and even the village level. And at each level, there are elders as well as leaders who oversee conflicts, resolution, at the same time, the well-being of the whole community. And I think it's possible here, and I do know it's also existing in some other parts of Asia, but the fact that there is a strong community, a belonging, a feeling of belonging to the community, and also the value and harmony and some hierarchy makes it possible. So this is just an expansion of that comment, which I think is very, very important to consider in governance.
Thank you very much. Please, gentlemen.
As you say, resources are scarce. So my question to you is whether you feel the need for rather an integrated and coordinated governance policy whereby the government, the private sector, and the NGO sector collaborates. And for example, to give an example that, let's say, the NGOs need capacity building to build capacities of the farmer communities. Now, to what extent they can go on building capacities of farmer communities? A project can do probably 100 groups, 200 groups, and you can have 3-4 projects in the country, but that would not cover the whole country. So what we need is the private sector and the government and the NGOs coordinate their resources so that they can extend throughout the country. Now, I would like your reflection on this point, whether and where you have an example of that collaboration between the different entities.
Yes, for our panel members, please. Who wants to take the question, please?
It looks like it's a tough nut to crack. But obviously, we are in agreement with the principle. There is no one man who can develop a country. Everyone must unite and coordinate efforts. A country cannot be developed by an NGO or government itself or the private sector itself. That's why we emphasize the need for coordination, actually. We had raised this in our presentation. It's extremely important that and the means and the information and all the efforts be coordinated to defeat this lack of sector development. And this, in some cases, is being done. There are several countries where this is being done and should be encouraged, to my view. That's what I can say.
I would just like to compliment Nathanael's comments by saying that we increasingly hear about public-private partnerships, and I think it's a way to promote good governance, because it means that the private sector has to be accountable to the government, and the government also has to be accountable to the private sectors for its actions and decisions. So it's again an illustration of how coordination can happen.
This will always be difficult, but I think would be the best approach in the Africa region now. Of course, with support from FAO, we are seeing increasingly the need to have either an advisory body or kind of task force comprised of private sector and civil organizations working at the top with the ministry is responsible actually to review policies and work with the ministry in even implementing this downward. The problem is historically we have the governed and the governors, and getting a balance there is always a challenging game. But if you can get the parties work, especially to start with non-controversial issues, I think an integrated approach would be the right way to go.
Thank you very much. Now we're going to take the two last questions from a gentleman here first, and then from Turkey.
Hello, this is Deep Swar. I am from Nepal. Governance becomes very complex when there is a conflict of interest. For example, if there is a water body, public water body, and if it is utilized by more than one purpose, then aquaculture becomes in the least priority. For example, in Nepal, we have several lakes, and most of them are being used for drinking water purpose, for navigation purpose, for hydropower generation purpose, for electricity, for irrigation purpose, and also for aquaculture. So, different departments of the government, they are all putting their own influence, and nobody knows whom that water body belongs. Fisheries say that is our water body, irrigation say that is their water body, forestry say that is their water body, and municipality says that is their water body. Everybody is trying to take as much as possible in their own favor. But as you know, the fisheries being dealt by the poorest community of the society, and they get the least priority, and they are the most sufferer. I wonder if any other countries are facing such problem, and if you have any magic answer for that. Thank you very much.
Yes, please.
I don't think there is a magic answer to it, but there are possible ways of solving them, and the code of conduct has provided a way out for us to follow. I think it's the Article 8 which talks about the integrated coastal zone management. And this is where I think emphasis needs to be laid, you know, in the different countries. When you have those multiple use resources where you need to come together to make sure that the people share those resources, it would not be equitably shared, but at least everybody would have his place in what is happening. And this can be done if you do two major things. One, you have to carry out an institutional analysis, and you have to take into account the stakeholder analysis. If you are able to do this, then you know what the interests of the different groups are and how you can go ahead to arrange it. We don't have time, so I can't go into much detail to explain this. Thank you.
I just want to add that in my experience, where the community sense is weak, the cracks up in governance, which ministry, which municipal become very obvious. But, you know, the community level, they're interested in everything. And they will try, if the sense is strong, they will try to balance this out. And most times shield us against the cracks. So, again, I want to emphasize that strengthening and empowering the community would help heal some of these rifts, which may always be there anyway.
Okay, thank you very much. Now, the last question, please, from our friend from Turkey.
My name is Hayri Deniz from Turkey. First of all, thank you for very good presentations. I think that I don't have the question, just reflection. Yes, governance is very important and for sustainability, for better management of aquaculture. I think that is the, first of all, we need to improve the institutional capacity. In case of Turkey, there are many institutions and ministries involved in the aquaculture, even each other's. There is no better understanding. There are many laws and regulations overlapping and discussion and between each other. I think that first of all we need to better understanding each other and consensus, even opposite NGOs for further development of sustainability of the aquaculture. I think that is very important. Also, we take care to integrate the coastal zone management. Otherwise, we cannot manage our sector without integrating the other coastal users, coastal sectors. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We are taking note of these comments. You, please, if you have any.
I would just like to comment on the last gentleman's point that Turkey is in the position that many countries in the world are, even those with established aquaculture industries, like Ireland, for example, where typically aquaculture is governed by land law, property law, water law, environmental law, agricultural law. And there's no doubt when you reach the liftoff point, where if aquaculture is to be encouraged, it needs a lead agency to help sort out the roles of those various approval agencies which have their say. But it seems that to me that a lead agency is frequently required to get aquaculture off the ground when it's reached that initial point.
Good. Thank you very much. So we will stop here. Can I ask the audience for a big round of applause for all the panelists? Thank you very much.